everyone, and welcome to Minute 126 of Season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the early podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Matthew Simpson, a freelance film and television critic. Welcome back to the show this season, Matthew.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to find some time to join us again. Always enjoyable, even if we're not talking Star Trek. What can you do?
Or Die Hard.
Yeah. Or Die Hard. That's true. Okay, well, that happens also. What can I tell you? So, why don't we right out of the gate talk about what's your history with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? Is it something that you've seen a lot? A little? Any thoughts on the movie?
Yeah. So this movie came out in 1998 when I was 17 and working at the local cinema in my tiny hometown. So I saw this in cinemas when it came out. I projected it when it came out. And I remember being blown away from it, or by it rather. I was already a pretty big Spielberg fan at the time. And this is one of the ones that like, yeah, there was a time where I was a big Spielberg fan because of his sort of popcorn fare, like Jurassic Park and Raiders and The Last Crusade and that kind of film. And this one, along with Schindler's List, are two that really cemented him for me as like pretty much like one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. So, and I've seen it a lot. I've seen it probably at least, I don't know how many times I've seen it. I used to watch it all the time. I used to watch it every year, and I've watched it at least a couple of times in the past couple of years. So, wow. I've seen it a lot of times.
How many times? I know that it's just the guesstimation, but how many times do you think you saw it when you were working the projector in the theater? You think you saw it like a lot then, or you would like? I mean, I don't know how big of a multiplex it was. You know, if there was, you know, if it was a movie theater that had 5 movies or a movie that had 20 movies, you know, so.
No. I grew up in a very small town where our local movie theater was also a community hall. So it only showed 2 movies at a time because there was only one screen and one projector with a 3-platter projector system. And so I actually only watched it in cinemas, that cinema, once, because I was only obligated to watch it once. Because when you assemble films onto a platter system, you kind of have to watch them to make sure you didn't F it up. So I always watched, I basically had to watch movies on Friday night. It was the best job ever. And, but when it eventually came out on TV, like we had HBO when I was a kid, across the border, very gray market and ethically dubious technically, but we had, so I watched it on HBO a ton, and I've owned it on various formats since. I used to have it on DVD. And Blu-ray, I don't actually own it right now because of reasons, but it is one I'm looking to add back to my collection. So it's just one of those films that, like, you know, if it's on TV, I'm going to watch it. And I do own it on, I believe, on iTunes. And last night I watched it on Paramount Plus. Like, it's just one of those movies that if it's around and it's on, I'm gonna sit down and be like, I'm going to watch it.
Okay. Yeah. Did you rewatch it last night by yourself, or did you get any family members to join in?
No, my wife went to bed because she works on Sundays, and so I watched it by myself. And that means that at the end, I cried by myself. So it's fine.
Wait, so if you were watching it with her, you wouldn't have cried, or you wouldn't have cried by yourself?
Well, I wouldn't have cried by myself.
Oh, okay.
I still would have cried. I'm not a monster.
Yes. No, I understand. It's completely understandable here. You know, do you know if your wife is a fan of this movie or not?
She is. She was actually annoyed at me when she found out I was going to watch it without her. So she has good taste as well.
Ah, okay. So you're slightly in the doghouse. You got now you have to rewatch it with her.
Oh yeah, it's the worst thing ever. I'll have to rewatch a great movie a second time.
Exactly. All right, makes sense. All right, so minute 126 begins with Ryan continuing his story, and ends with Miller keeping his own secret. So, I mean, we ended things on Friday in the middle of Ryan telling his story about his brothers and, you know, the thinking about the you know, the last time with the context of trying to figure out when he last saw his brothers and stuff like that. And, you know, the story sort of got cut off towards the end because, you know, we had to wait until today to finish the story. So he was talking about the fact that, you know, he and two of his brothers, you know, for anyone who's less familiar or doesn't remember what we talked about on Friday. So, you know, he and two of his brothers were peeking in on their oldest brother, Dan, who was in the middle of trying to make it with one of the girls from the town who apparently was not very easy on the eyes, I guess you can say. Even though we talked about this last week, in the original script, it actually said that she was gorgeous. You know, it was a complete opposite story. And, you know, it was Matt Damon who apparently ad-libbed it and changed the story and stuff like that, you know, to make it, I guess, a little funnier or something like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, Ryan's continuing his story here. And he goes, at the same time, he picks up a shovel and he's going after Sean. And Sean says, what are you trying to hit me for? I did you a favor. And so this makes Dan even more angry. He tries to swing this thing. He loses the shovel. It goes out of his grasp and hits a kerosene lantern. The thing explodes. The whole barn almost goes up because of this thing. And then he, like, pauses. Now, first of all, you know, the way that this story goes, you know, on the one hand, I like it, and I love Matt Damon's delivery here. But on the other hand, I always get the feeling that the story goes a little too far because they go into slapstick comedy type of aspects of it. You know, which again makes it entertaining to listen to. But it makes it that I don't know how much I believe that this is exactly all that happened.
I mean, this is definitely not exactly what happened because it's the kind of story you definitely embellish. I've always kind of liked it. I actually like the end of it where he sort of trails off as he realizes that was the last time they were all together. And it's also just the kind of story that, like, you know, if you have a big family or lots of siblings or cousins or whatever that you grew up with, like, it's the kind of story you tell. And it's the kind of story that, like, you know, you don't let the truth get in the way of a good yarn. It's
that kind of story. I agree. And, you know, just, for some reason, I think that it just goes slightly too far with the way that he's telling the story. But okay, I do hear what you're saying about the fact that, okay, so he's embellishing it a little bit. You know, I have a cousin that used to always tell his kids, you know, that at their wedding there was a you know, they had, like, they created a jump rope out of napkins and people were jumping on it and the jump rope broke. And it hit the cake, and the cake fell down, which none of that ever happened. You know, but he liked to embellish the fact that, you know, those type of things happen. So I guess from that perspective, it sort of makes sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of a dumb story, don't get me wrong. But it's kind of endearing as a result.
Correct.
Which I've always liked about it.
Right. I don't know if dumb is the right word for it, but it sounds like a quote-unquote hick type of story.
Yeah, and it's also definitely like a fish story, right? Like, I'm sure that he was with a girl. I'm sure she wasn't that attractive, but maybe not the ugliest girl you've ever seen. I'm sure that, like, it wasn't the, like, swinging of the shovel that knocked over the kerosene lantern. I'm sure the barn didn't go up and, you know, didn't almost go up in flames entirely. It's it's that kind of story.
Right. And I mean, and again, you know, we talked about this on Friday that this girl, you know, basically was unconscious, which already goes into other areas that probably shouldn't be discussed, you know, about what's really going on there. You know,
the most difficult bit to believe of it for me is actually the bit where he talks about how she got up and runs away and runs into a wall and knocks herself out. I'm sure she just went outside. You know, it's just one of those stories where things escalate every time you tell it.
Right. That's true. And then, so like I said, we have about 15 seconds, which is a long time in a movie, to have just the camera focus on a character telling a story, and it's just done so well, because he like trails off and then he goes, that was it, that was the last, that was, Dan went off to basic the next day, that was the last night the four of us were together. Now, we talked about this particular scene, I think it was in episode 32, or maybe it was 33, when Hal Bryant was on. Because, you know, when they show the scene where Mrs. Ryan is being told, you know, she's getting the telegrams, you know, that three of her sons are, you know, have been lost in battle. So you see pictures on the mantle, and one of them shows four soldiers together. So it's a little strange that here he says this was the last night that we were all together. But then how did they have a picture of the four of them, you know, in on the mantle?
Maybe it's just the last time they were all together at home.
Okay, yeah, that's the simple answer.
I don't have a good answer.
That is the simple answer, because he also says that was the last night that the four of us were together. So okay, it's the last night, but you know, when we were all in the army, we were in basic or wherever we are, you know, we happened to be near each other, and we just took a picture and sent it home. I mean, that's a possibility also.
Yeah.
But it's just very funny, you know, when you look at a movie like this minute by minute. So obviously, you know, you're going to notice things that people don't normally notice. And that was something that Hal and I noticed. You know, they have this picture of four guys that theoretically, according, if you take this the script at face value, that was the last time they were together. You know, you have to go into the details and saying, okay, that was the last night. Okay, so maybe it wasn't during the night; it was during the day. You know, all these different ways of trying to get out of that particular thing.
Yeah, I like to think that maybe. Maybe it is just the last time that they were at home together, at ease together. Right. There's lots of ways to explain away the photograph, even just that, like, you know, they all joined the army. Presumably they're pretty close in age, as, you know, brothers in that time frame tended to be. And so maybe they just had a moment, you know, they ran into each other in England pre-invasion or something like that, and snapped a photo.
Well, that wouldn't have happened because
at a moment.
There's a slight flaw in that one, is that one of them was in the Pacific.
Right.
I believe it was Daniel, that you know, his oldest brother that died in the Pacific.
Yeah, you're right. Thinking about it,
right. Yeah. No. Matthew, it's perfectly okay. You're not expected to know this movie backwards and forwards like I do.
Yeah. I'm just saying that, like. I think it's reasonable to you know, remember that as their last time at home or as civilians, or, you know, before everything changed, at least, would be the right way to put it, maybe.
Okay. I mean, again, that's completely fair. I mean, would it basically, and then he continues and says, that was 2 years ago. So that also says a lot. You know, it's like they're telling us that basically around June 1942 was when Dan enlisted, you know, so that's also a long time between now and then. That's, you know, thinking about it, it makes you think about the fact that, you know, the way that this war went, you know, there are people who didn't see each other. They didn't see family members for years. You know, it's not like you watch a Vietnam movie, okay, and they have 1 year that they're in country, that type of thing, and they're, so, you know, sometimes they get a break in the middle and whatever. But here, you know, this was 25 years earlier or 30 years earlier, and these people basically, you know, he's talking about the fact that he hasn't basically seen his brother for pretty much 2 years. That's a hell of a long time. But mm-hmm. It tells us so much about that time, you know, that time in space, I guess you can say.
Yeah, right? It also tells us that you know, potentially at least that eldest brother enlisted after Pearl Harbor. June would have been about the Battle of Midway in the Pacific, which is about what, six months after Pearl Harbor was. So
Pearl Harbor was December.
Maybe he was waiting for his 18th birthday, or maybe he joined up and wasn't, ordered to report until whatever it is. But as many, I believe, did, probably speaking that he enlisted, after the attack of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. And I mean, I would assume actually that Daniel must have been older. I mean, we don't know what number brother James is. You know, for some reason, we just always assume that he's the youngest brother.
I think they say it. They say it. Did you say
it's the youngest?
They say it at the beginning, when they're talking about when Bryan Cranston and the other officer are handing the files to the general. They talk about how, only the youngest one is alive.
Okay. So given the fact that, let's say, that, Jimmy Ryan is supposed to be 19 or 20 or something like that at this point. So even if we go by standards that there's a year between all of them, right, it would mean that Dan is probably 23, that type of thing. So it might have been that he enlisted when he was 21. That's if Dan's the oldest.
Yeah.
Again, we can assume that Dan's the oldest because he's the first one to go off to basic training.
That all makes sense.
Right. Now, last week I talked a little bit about the way that it's presented in the novelization. So at this point, first of all, they give us a great shot of Miller, who we just see him contemplating the situation, and that he sees the reason for the pause, and he understands it himself. That, you've just told this story, and now it's bringing up all these memories of these three brothers who are no longer around, and Alice Jardine, who might be still unconscious. But, Tom Hanks once again shows, and I pointed this out many times in this movie, how many times that he, just by his facial expressions, you can tell so much about his character, about how much he understands things as they're happening and as they're going on and stuff like that. So we just get a nice little lingering shot of a few seconds, showing that he's thinking about what's going on and realizes specifically the issues of the effects of this type of story. Okay. And in the movie, the next line, he said, basically, at this point, Miller says, "Oh my." And then Ryan looks at him and goes, "Tell me about your wife and those rose bushes." And then once again, we get him thinking for a fraction of a second. And then he goes, no, that one I'm just going to save just for me. Which is great. Now, in the novelization, it's slightly different. he finishes, Ryan finishes telling his story. And then it says, Edith Piaf is still singing. Ryan goes, "Wow, that's a long record." He goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "How about you tell me one? Tell me about the hammock, why don't you?" So just to refresh everyone's memory, Miller mentions that, he can recall, just sitting in his hammock as he's watching his wife, prune the rose bushes. So his response here is, okay, it's in the backyard. Because he said, so I'm lying there half asleep, listening for the sound of breaking glass. And that's all it takes to take me back home. Why? Why breaking glass? You got to understand, I got the best house in all of Adley. Not the biggest house or most expensive, but it's got the best damn windows a baseball coach could ask for. See, we're right next to the junior high. Or that is, we're behind the junior high baseball field. The garage windows face left field. The guy who owned the place before me put screens over the windows. But the first thing I did after I bought that place was take those damn screens off. Why? Well, think about it. 322 feet from home plate to my garage windows. Takes one hell of a junior high baseball player to hit the ball that far, that high. I look at my garage windows as my baseball scouts, looking out for the junior high kids that are going to pave my way to a state high school championship. Every time I hear breaking glass when I'm lying in my hammock, I just smile and smile, knowing I'm that much closer to a winning season. That was swell, Captain. Now, how about you tell me about your wife and those roses? Miller ponders. I don't think so. I think I'll keep that one just for me. So I like the way that, I mean, again, it's more concise in the movie, but it tells us so much more about Miller. The fact that he's, you know, that he actually has this thought out about being, you know, about his garage door windows being the best baseball scout that he could have. You know, that type of thing.
So, yeah, it's like such that. A great moment, too. I actually didn't know this about the script. And it also just makes like that moment where he says he's going to keep the story about his wife just for himself sort of a little more personal.
Yeah.
You know, like, I will tell you this story, but I won't tell you that one.
Right.
Is kind of lovely, actually. I really appreciate it. It does feel the kind of thing that would definitely, like, if it was cut, it was probably cut for time. Because it sounds like a great scene. But it is, that's lovely. I'm going to have to go find that.
No, I don't, again, I don't know if they filmed it. I don't know where you'll be able to find it, because Spielberg doesn't, you know, I've yet to find Spielberg do a commentary, and I've yet to find Spielberg giving deleted scenes. I don't think he does. So if you find that, let me know. That would be great to hear that full thing. But I don't think it's out there. It's probably been destroyed.
Probably. Just trying to see if I can find a shooting script for it.
Okay. And that's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else that you wanted to mention?
No, only that. So this scene, and actually all the minutes we're talking about, are the tail end of one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is, I'm sure everyone who's following along knows, is the part where, you know, they've set up the town and they're just waiting for the Germans to arrive. And this whole sequence, including the minutes you must have covered last week, and this week, where they're sort of forestalling or sort of like waiting on the inevitable, trying to be human, trying to be patient for all these tanks to show up, is one of my favorite acting sequences in the movie. But just the men being the men and trying to find some sense of normalcy. I really like this whole part of the movie. Like, the battle scenes are great, but this, I think, is one of the most human scenes in the movie, which I really appreciate.
Oh, well, very cool. All right, so every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guest will give their top five John Williams movie theme scores, however you want to look at that. So, Matthew, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
So difficult, because he's done so many and they're all so iconic. But I'm going to say... I'm going to preface this by saying that, like, if you ask me tomorrow, that'll probably be in a different order, at least. But I'm going to say my number five is the score to Steven Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can, which is a wonderful sort of, like, horn-first, sort of jazzy, 60s-inspired, sort of, not James Bond, but, like, sort of spy thriller-type-inspired score. I really like that one. Probably the most different of all the ones that he has in my top five. I'm going to say my number four is his iconic score to Superman. I don't know. It's like so iconic that they've decided to use it again in the marketing for the upcoming Superman movie. And if you get a chance, let me tell you, if you get a chance to see it played live, you should definitely do that. My local, the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra does movie nights where they play the score live, and Superman is incredible to see live.
Oh, wow.
Where are we going to go from here? I'm going to say that for me, the next one is probably very specifically Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Obviously, the Indiana Jones theme is iconic, but Last Crusade is my favorite of those movies, which I know makes me a little bit of an outlier.
You're
but
not
I really
the first
like.
person to put it on this list.
Fair enough. I just know a lot of people would say that Raiders is the best one, but Last Crusade is easily my favorite. And all the music that plays, especially between Indy and his father, is great. So that's two left. So I'm going to cheat on your list, just for the record. But my number two is going to be Star Wars. And in particular, the score to The Last Jedi, I think, is one of his most mature, which I know is saying a lot about John Williams, but it's most mature and, interestingly, one of his most energetic and most interestingly arranged of those scores. And the way he reuses themes from the earlier movies, especially in that sequence where the Millennium Falcon is flying through the salt planet, is just legitimately incredible. And so I'm going to put a tie at number one because I can't decide between these two. And that's going to be the iconic Jaws score and also Jurassic Park, which is the film that made me fall in love with movies. So I can't decide between them.
Yeah, okay. I want to force you to because, you know, everyone else did it.
Yeah, I mean, fine. Jurassic Park. No, Jaws. No, Jurassic Park. No, Jaws. No, Jurassic Park. No, Jaws. We'll say Jurassic Park, and then I'll flip a coin, and later it'll be Jaws. How about that? Okay, so 1A and 1B, Jurassic Park and Jaws.
Okay, fair enough. All right, excellent. Thank you very much for that list. So, Matthew, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
The easiest way to find me online is just to visit my personal portfolio page, which is stretched.ca. I'm a freelance critic and writer, so I link to all the stuff that I put out there. You can also find me on the socials. I am at SmatthewAF in most places, most actively on Blue Sky and Threads these days. And then last but not least, you can also find me last year, at the end of 2022, I should say, I co-founded a local critics group. So you can also find some of my work and also many of my colleagues by visiting the website for the Cascadia Film and Television Critics Association, which is CascadiaCritics.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. In my solitude, you